Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And our guest today is joining us for the second time, I believe. It's been a few years, though. Raeann Thain. She is a New York Times, USA Today, and number one Publishers Weekly best-selling author. She finds inspiration in the beautiful northern Utah mountains where she lives with her family. Her stories have been described as poignant and sweet and with beautiful, honest storytelling that goes straight to the heart. And she loves to hear from readers and can be reached through her website at www.raeannthain.com. And I'm going to spell that because it's a little unusual. R-A-E-A-N-N-E-T-H-A-Y-N. Welcome back to Writer's Voices, Raeann.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And we're here today to talk to a somewhat Christmas-themed book, Snowkissed. Now, how many books have you published? What does this come in at?
This one, I believe, is, let me do the math a little bit. I think this is 77. I finished 78. I'm working on 79 right now.
Wow. That is kind of amazing.
Well, in fairness, I sold my first book 30 years ago. So I've been at this for a long time and consistently published since then.
Still more than two books a year. And that's like a full-time job for sure.
It is my job. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So now you started, I believe, as a journalist.
I did. Yes. I had a degree in journalism and sort of, I really loved that part of writing, but I kind of knew the whole time I was working as a newspaper editor and reporter that I wanted to write books. I didn't know where to start. I didn't know anything about writing fiction, but you know, that was my dream. I was an avid reader from the time I was very young. And so this was sort of everything I ever wanted to do. And then one day I was home on maternity leave with our daughter, who's now 30, she'll be 36 this summer. I decided, okay, now's the time to start. I've got a little bit of time with this baby who sleeps occasionally, not that often, but I decided that was the time to write. And so I did both. I mean, for about, let's see, I wrote about 5 years while I was a newspaper editor, news editor at a daily newspaper, and was just trying to figure out what I wanted to do, what kind of stories I wanted to write, and did that early in the mornings and on my days off and things like that. I sold my first book in 95, and it came out in 96, and I left the newspaper business in 97 and have been doing the writing and mom thing full time since then.
Wow. Well, congratulations. And you make it sound easy, but I bet it wasn't quite that easy.
It was not. I mean, there were a lot of rejections along the way, you know, and I think I don't think any writer gets through this process without having some rejections and some things that sort of hit your self-esteem and you think, well, maybe I'm fooling myself to think I could ever do this, you know, but it has not been easy even along the way. Juggling family is a difficult thing. You know, we have a special needs child and so that adds a little extra component of stress to things. But you know, you just, it's my dream. It's my job now. And so that you make time for it and make it work.
You know, it's interesting because in Snowkissed, your protagonist has a special needs child. And I was impressed with how, I don't know how real that seemed, and now I know why.
Right, and our son does not. So in the book, that the heroine has a 5-year-old daughter, Lydia, who has Down syndrome. Our son has cerebral palsy, so it's totally different. But he's 28 now, and he's, for all his life, we've been surrounded by all his friends that have Down syndrome, so we're very well acquainted with that. You know, side of things. And we see, you know, their struggles are very different from our struggles, but we're all part of sort of the same team. And we all understand a lot of the same struggles that you go through as a parent. And every parent worries about their child and wants the very best for their child. But when you have a child with special needs, there's an added measure of mama bear that comes out because you know that you've got to protect your child and do the best. And that's really what Holly, the heroine in this book, does. And that, I think that was a great part of her character. Just the fact that she really is everything she does is aimed toward giving her daughter the best life, even if it's not things that necessarily she feels like are in her best interest, but they're in her daughter's best interest. So she kind of sacrifices, which I think all parents are used to doing for our kids.
Right, right. And I also really liked that you didn't make the fact that her daughter had Down syndrome as sort of a, it's a challenge for Holly. You know, it gives her challenges, but it's not a tragedy. It's not a...
No, absolutely not.
Yeah. And it's a joy, actually. But you also are very realistic about that for some other people, it's a little... It takes some of the other characters a little longer to realize that.
Right. I think that that's absolutely true. I've seen it very often in the years that we've been part of that community, that it's very destructive, can be really destructive on marriages. You know, there's a high divorce rate among parents of children with special needs. And because there's so much added pressure and, you know, financial and medical and all the other things that they're dealing with. And so I think that was sort of what broke up the marriage, Holly's marriage, was that her ex just couldn't deal with this, and his expectations for their child were not, you know, met necessarily. And it took him a lot longer to adjust. And I wanted to show he did. He wasn't necessarily a bad guy, or she wouldn't have married him, but it took him longer to kind of come to terms with the fact that their daughter was not going to be perfect. And it helped that he had a new wife and a new family, and his wife was pushing him to have a better relationship with their child. And so that was kind of one of the underlying themes of the story, is that it's a process for everyone, and we all go through it our own pace.
Yeah, you don't have, your characters are very well drawn, for one thing, but they're also, there aren't any really bad guys. Now, is this common for you?
Well, you know, it is, and I sometimes think, well, I need a villain or something. But I think, especially in the case when people are divorced, and, you know, I want to show them finding a new relationship, I have a really hard time drawing a really bad person that they were married to, because that says something about that person sometimes, about the choices that they made in their life, you know. And so you can make mistakes and not be right for each other, but that doesn't make the other person necessarily bad. Certainly he was immature. He wasn't a great dad for the first several years of his daughter's life. And so you could say he's bad, but I want to show growth in all of my characters. And even the people who are the antagonists, certainly there's room for growth in all of us.
And it would have been kind of common and easy maybe to make the new wife who was the mistress be the bad person.
Right.
But you avoid that trope too.
I know. All my people are sometimes a little too nice. And I do. I mean, I can't say that I always write good people, because I've written romantic suspense where there's bad guys, and I've written, you know, other storylines where there's people that aren't good. But my favorite story arc is redemption. And I actually, I had one series where I had one person who was absolutely the bad person, because she was, you know, really caused a lot of problems for the other characters in the first three books of the series. I made her a heroine, actually, down the line, and redeemed her, kind of to show where she was from the beginning. And she became one of my most favorite characters. I just loved her story arc, because she started out in a place where she had a lot of room to grow. She was spoiled and selfish and you know, not a very nice person. But by the time I got five books in the series, you know, she'd had a lot of growth there. And I think, because I guess maybe I'm optimistic, but I want to think that all of us, there's room for all of us to be better people and to become better people.
So Snowkissed is a romance, but it's the focus isn't really so much on the romance. It's really on the family dynamics.
Right, right. Yeah. And I've written lots of Christmas books. And every time I write one, I think, well, what's different that I can do in this particular story? But one thing that's I think a common thread in all Christmas books that I tend to write is that Christmas is messy. It's not perfect for anybody. There's always something wrong in everybody's family dynamic, and, you know, and we all have to deal with that. And the holidays tend to amplify all of those things that we're struggling with. And so I like to write about those family dramas. In this particular case, the main male character has a strained relationship with his father that has affected his relationship also with his sister and his sister's daughter. And so he's removed himself basically from family celebrations for most of his adult life. And now, because of circumstances, he's forced to interact with his dad, and he's forced to, you know, be present for Christmas with his sister and his sister's daughter. And so he kind of has to do that to help his sister. But it forces him to confront a lot of these things that he's kind of thrown in the background and said, this isn't important to me right now. But now he has to, because of the situation, and has to deal with these emotions that he's dealt with his father, and try to find forgiveness for maybe some of the mistakes that his father made. And again, going back to the things we talked about earlier, his dad was not a bad person, although he thought he was. You know, Ryan, the main male character, was very angry with his father because of the way his father treated the death of his wife, who died of cancer, and wasn't there for his kids, and was very remote and distant, sent them off to boarding school, left them to grieve alone, basically, for their mother, and didn't give them the emotional support they needed. And so he's resentful of this. And now he has to interact with this man who now is living this life where he's got this new wife who's really nice and warm and kind, and he has to reconcile the man that he grew up with to the man his dad now is 25 years later, you know, and think of how can I reconcile that childhood dad I had to this adult dad, and we can have a relationship together. So that was his story, as I weave that through.
Right,
what
I
was dealing with, which is the setup for her story, is that she's she has a child who's been asked to be the flower girl for her ex-sister-in-law's wedding. So her ex-husband and his new wife and family are coming to town. They've moved away. For the last 2 years, she's been on her own, basically raising this daughter. And her ex-husband's coming back for this wedding for the holidays. And she knows she's going to have to confront him and deal with him. She's feeling like kind of the other woman in all these festivities that she's going to have to be a part of with his family. So she enlists the help of Ryan as a fake date, basically. It's a fake dating trope to help her through this wedding complication in her life, and just to have this really, you know, sexy arm candy at the wedding, so that she won't feel, you know, make people uncomfortable about her, and that she will feel a little more confident to be surrounded by all these other people that, you know that her husband left her for this other woman. And so, you know, that's kind of the backup story there. Her trying to figure out, how do I navigate all these custody issues, all these, you know, this family is going to be in her daughter's life forever, because they're always going to be her daughter's grandparents and aunt and uncle, even though she and her ex are no longer together. So she knows she has to keep a relationship with them. And how do you do that? And the holidays, again, so complicating for people who are divorced, having to figure out, do I have custody this year? Am I going to have to be without my kids at Christmas?
Yeah.
And all those emotional things that people have to deal with.
And this book is set in a small town in Idaho. Right.
So, right.
Is it an actual town that it's based on, or is it a made up town?
It's a made up town. All my towns are made up. I find it so much easier I take things that I like in actual towns and incorporate those, but I like having my own community that I can name the streets. I can name the mayor. I can have somebody be the new fire chief or whatever, so that people aren't saying, well, hey, that's not, my street is not there or whatever. But it's loosely based on McCall, Idaho, which is outside of Boise, and it's on a big lake. And that's kind of the center point of this entire series, is that there's this big giant lake there that is a recreational place. And it's a beautiful place, beautiful surroundings for people in it. I love writing books set in the West. I live in Northern Utah, so I'm like 15 miles from the Idaho border. So I know that area and I know the West. I've always lived in the West since high school anyway. And this is what I like to write about, the mountains and recreational opportunities that we have here that are so abundant here.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Rae Ann Thayne, author of Snowkissed. You mentioned that this is a series. What are the other books in this series?
So this series is called Shelter Springs. This is the third book in the series, and the first one is Christmas at the Shelter Inn. The second one is The December Market, and then this one is Snowkissed. And it's a Christmas-themed, every year I'll have a new book in this series for the next little while anyway. I don't know how long the series will go, but I should say it is a spinoff of a previous series that I did called Haven Point, which was set at the same lake, just a neighboring town from Shelter Springs. And so I was looking for a place that I could put a Christmas-themed, you know, Christmas-themed series, because my readers tend to love connected books. They love stories that, you know, even though the books are totally standalone, they have different protagonists. Everything is, you know, it's a totally new story. They like when characters pop in again that they know. It's like visiting old friends, I think, for me as an author and also for my readers. And so I love doing that. So I thought, I want to find a place where I can write this Christmas-themed series. And it made sense to just, I had this other town that I'd already created for in my Haven Point series. It was a neighboring town called Shelter Springs. And I just thought that's a perfect place for me to put this. So it's worked out.
I wondered if I knew that you had a book, The December Market, and in Snowkissed, there is a Christmas market in Shelter Springs. Yeah. So I wondered if that was the same.
It is. It's the same town. And the series starts at the Shelter Inn, which is a retirement community that used to be a hotel, and they've made it into a retirement community. And that was the very first book in the series.
And when did that come out?
That one came out two Christmases ago. Okay. So that would have been 2023. And then 2024 was the December market. And then this one, and then I'm working on the next year's book, which is tentatively titled, I believe, A Cozy Little Christmas. And it's about the twin sister of Holly, who's the protagonist, the female protagonist of this book.
So who was the protagonist in the first two?
So the first the female protagonist was Natalie Shepherd. I'm going to forget names because after 78 books,
No kidding.
I have to keep a Bible or I forget who everybody is and where what their interaction is. But she was a freelance editor, basically wrote travel articles, hadn't lived in town for many, many years. And she comes back to town for Christmas, kind of to help out her sister, which is also kind of a theme in my book, helping family. So she comes back to town to help her sister and meets up with someone that she knew in the past. And then the next story is her friend, Amanda, and the sister of the hero of that book. And then Holly and Hannah, who are the next two, are good friends with those two women. And so it's kind of a group of women who knew each other in high school, were great friends in high school, have gone their separate ways, have lived different experiences, and now for different reasons are back in this community and finding their way together.
So you mentioned the fake dating trope, and you even in the book, Holly and Hannah are joking about the fake dating
right
trope. You know, they know that they're actually participate or doing it themselves, you know, but
it starts out as a joke where she says that's what she needs, you know, is a great guy, and her sister kind of goes behind her back and talks to Ryan and says, you know, my sister really needs help. I think you need to help her. And for various reasons, he agrees. He has his own reasons for agreeing. And so, and I have been talking about this book, I realized I've never in all these books done this trope before. I've never written fake dating.
Wow.
This is the very first time.
Oh my gosh.
And I don't know why, because it's one of my favorites to read. I just love that idea of you're doing something for show, but it becomes real, you know, as you get to know each other. It's a forced proximity thing where they have to be together, and in that process they discover that they have feelings for each other, that they're really perfect for each other. It just took this excuse to be together for them to figure that out, and it was really, really fun. I loved writing that trope. I love these two people. They were some of my favorite characters that I've written.
Well, then I was trying to think, what are some of the other tropes in romance books? I know that there's the enemies to lovers,
right?
There's certainly the going back to the hometown and reconnecting with someone from your past. So are those the two that you tend to write the most?
I don't know about enemies to lovers. I do that occasionally, but a lot of times mine are friends to lovers.
Ah.
Or, you know, that seems to be one of the things that appeals to me the most. People that were good friends and then suddenly are seeing each other in a different light. I like to write that particular trope a lot. I do write a lot of, you know, coming back to your town, or especially because I feel like why did these people not get together before if they've lived in the same town forever? So usually it's somebody has to have moved away and now they're at a different stage of their life and they come back and they are able to kind of rediscover each other. I do like writing, you know, strangers to lovers. That's another one where they just meet up for various reasons and get together. What's one of the other tropes that I like to write? I've never written A Marriage of Convenience. That's one I like to read because I like to read historical romances. I like that idea. It's nothing you can really do very well in a contemporary romance, though, because why do people have to get married anyway?
Yeah.
In this day and age, you know, but there are just so many wonderful, fun ones, you know, that are Grumpy Sunshine is another one that I tend to write a lot, where one character is quite grumpy and the other one is this bright, happy person and brings out the sunshine in the other person.
And how do you make, when you're writing one of these, how do you make it fresh and new?
That's a really good question. And especially this is my 23rd Christmas book. So I've done lots and lots of Christmas books. So I know what there are certain expectations when you write a Christmas book. You want it to start usually around Thanksgiving, and you've got basically a month to make this romance happen. And so it's difficult, but it's the characters who make it fresh. It's characters who are dealing with different situations in their lives. You know, I've never written a Christmas book with a woman who's a divorced mom who has a special needs child. I've never done particularly Ryan's situation where he's at a crossroads in his own life, and he's also at a crossroads in trying to figure out his emotional connection with his father, you know. And so every character is different. And so that means every story is by necessity going to be different because they're dealing with different things and they're in different places at the beginning of the book and they need to end up in different places at the end of the book. So that makes the dialogue different and the plot devices I'm going to use different. Certainly there are certain, I wouldn't call them constraints, but certain, you know, things I want to include, like there's going to be some kind of outdoor thing that they do, especially when I write books that are set in the Rocky Mountains. There's going to be snow, of course, because that's what we deal with here, you know, shoveling snow and scraping cars and that sort of thing. Just the trials you live with in the mountains, you know. But recreational opportunities, sledding and skiing and those kind of fun things. And then, you know, I like to include like the magical elements of Christmas, the lights and the warm feelings that people have and singing together and that kind of thing.
Cocoa.
But cocoa, there's always cocoa somewhere in the book. Yeah. And just that I like my books to be something that people can relax into during the chaos of the holiday season, that they can be a book that they can just settle in. And maybe that's another reason that I don't do a lot of really ugly protagonists or antagonists, because I want this to be a book to remind people of the joy of the season, of what we celebrate and how whatever we celebrate, whether it's, you know, Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever, that there are certainly shared similarities in all the things that we celebrate and the love for other people and the kindness that we try to bring to other people.
Have you ever written a Hanukkah book?
I've not written a Hanukkah book, but I have included elements of Hanukkah in some of my books. I think maybe two books ago, they had a ceremony on the first day of Hanukkah to celebrate a beloved person who had passed away, who had been Jewish. So they now celebrate that part of it as well.
So, Rayanne, would you like to read a little bit from Snowkissed for us?
Sure. And I sat here thinking, what am I going to read? And it just made sense to start at the beginning of the book. And so I'm just going to read from the beginning, if that's all right.
Sure.
All right. One of these days, you need to learn how to say the word no. Holly Moore sighed as her twin sister's words seemed to ring through her little florist shop, resounding with truth. Hannah was almost always right. Her sister was one of the smartest women she knew, and Holly couldn't disagree with her about this. She had a problem with trying to please everyone, and she did need to learn how to say no. Most of the time, anyway. I can't, not in this case. Your former sister-in-law will survive if she doesn't have Lydia as her flower girl. She can find someone else. I'm sure there will be plenty of people who don't think she should do it anyway. Holly fought a sharp ache at the words. Her ex-husband's family loved Lydia and did their very best to embrace and include her, but she couldn't deny that there were plenty of other people in society who would prefer her daughter, and others with similar developmental disabilities stayed in the background where their presence wouldn't make anyone uncomfortable. Christine is a fantastic aunt to Lydia. They have a close relationship. It might not be as close as the one you have with Lydia, but Chris tries hard to be inclusive, which is why I can't refuse. Holly tucked a few more stems of greenery into the arrangement she was working on. Unfortunately, all the plans have been made, she went on. Christine has already talked to Lydia about it and showed her the dress she bought for her to wear. There's no turning back now. Hannah frowned. She should have asked you first before talking to Lydia. You can't unscatter dandelion fluff. It's done now. Lydia's all excited, even though she doesn't have any idea what being a flower girl involves. I mean, the dress is gorgeous. Velvet, red, with a little white faux fur collar. You and I would have loved to own a dress like that when we were flower girl age. I suppose you can't break her heart. Hannah gave her a sympathetic look. If our Lydia wants to be a flower girl, she won't easily budge. That girl is as stubborn as a mule on a mountain trail. You don't have to tell me. Her daughter might only be five, but Lydia had amply demonstrated her iron will in that handful of years. She had learned to walk before any of the doctors and specialists expected it. She had basically potty trained herself. She could write her name and she could pick out sight words. Most of the time, her determination filled Holly with pride. With all of her daughter's challenges, Lydia would need to be fierce as she confronted the world. But in certain circumstances, it could be tough for a mother, with her child's best interests at heart, to convince that child something she wanted might not be the best thing for her. Being Lydia's mother was a complete joy most of the time. Still, pitting her own will against that of a determined five-year-old girl who didn't always understand subtext or subtle nuances of meaning could sometimes be exhausting. Any five-year-old would probably be the same. Don't listen to me. I'm sure everything will be fine, Hannah assured her. Lydia will have a great time and look fabulous in her red velvet dress with the fake fur collar, and I have no doubt the flowers you're doing for the wedding will be amazing, as always. The thought of it all, along with everything else she had to do this month, left Holly exhausted. Her sister was absolutely right. She needed to learn how to say no. She should never have agreed to provide the floral decorations for her former sister-in-law's upcoming wedding and reception, especially when she'd already had two weddings booked for the month of December before Christine and Matt decided on a holiday ceremony. Beyond her wedding responsibilities, December was one of her busiest months of the year when people loved to buy wreaths, flowers for hostess gifts, or centerpieces for their holiday decorations. If she managed to get any sleep this month, it would be a true holiday miracle. I'll help you, Hannah assured her. You know I'm here to do anything you need, and all of us can pitch in to help you with Lydia. Mom and Dad love having her, and I'm sure we could talk the boys into helping too. The boys were their older brothers, Asher and Micah Goodwin, who also were helpless to resist Lydia when she put her mind to something. Her daughter was beloved by nearly everyone she met, which left Holly deeply grateful. Impulsively, she leaned over and hugged her sister, careful not to poke her with the stems of the white heath aster in her hand that she was using to fill in between the pink Gerbera daisies and baby roses. I know, thank you. I don't know what I would have done the past 2 years without all of you. Since her divorce, her family had rallied around her, helping her take over her aunt's florist shop, move into Rose Cottage, raise a special needs child. She would have been lost without them. Hannah hugged her in return. We've got you, she assured her. She stepped away and looked at the elaborate arrangement. This is really pretty. Who's the mom? Anyone I know? Holly stuck in that spray of aster before looking at the name on the order form. Dana Harris. I don't know her, do you? There was a time when she had been certain she knew every single person in their small Idaho town of Shelter Springs. Hannah frowned. Never heard of her. What's her husband's name? She looked at the form again. I don't know. I didn't have a chance to speak with him. Ginger took the order before she left to make deliveries. She didn't write his name down, only the words hot dad. Hannah laughed. Well, that's super helpful. Sounds like our Ginger, right? Ginger Martineau, one of four staff members at Evergreen and Ivy, might be scattered and easily distracted, but she was also creative, loyal, and hardworking. More importantly, her sunny attitude and whimsical sense of humor made Holly laugh in a world that sometimes didn't feel all that funny. Holly and her sisters were chatting about Hannah's work as a music therapist when the bells on her front door chimed and in walked the most gorgeous man Holly had ever seen in real life. He was tall, muscular, with a hard jawline, short dark hair, and stunning green eyes. She was aware of a completely inappropriate flutter of awareness. This must be the hot dad who had ordered the new baby flower arrangement. Although how Ginger had managed to deduce he was gorgeous simply over the phone, Holly had no idea. She did know she had never seen this man before in her life, or she absolutely would have remembered him. He looked around at her shop, bedecked for the holidays with three live trees, garlands, wreaths, and fairy lights. Somehow, the inherently feminine surroundings, flowery and cheerful, only served to make him look more gorgeously masculine in contrast. She gave him a bright smile. Hi, you're right on time. I just finished your order. Congratulations. She walked around the corner of the work table, holding out the lush arrangement in a pink container shaped like a large building block with the words, "It's a girl," on the front. He looked at it as if she'd held out a live barracuda. What's this? She tried not to bristle at his blatant rejection of something she had considered lovely, perfect for the situation. This is what you wanted for your wife, who just had a baby girl this morning. Congratulations again. The holidays are such a fun time to have a new baby. You must be so thrilled. What's her name? I think there's been some kind of mistake. She gazed down at her lovely creation and back at him, dismayed. Oh no, was it a boy? I'm so sorry. She seriously needed to have a long chat with Ginger about paying more attention to details. This wasn't the first order the other woman had typed wrong into the system, or even the first one this week. Don't worry at all. I can change it. Give me 5 minutes. I've got some pale roses and some blue aster that came in this, or some yellow aster that came in this morning. I can swap them out, and we can put everything in a different container. She hurried back behind her counter, but before she could start undoing all her hard work, he followed her. No, I think you've mistaken me for someone else. I don't have a wife or, God forbid, a newborn baby, girl or boy. Good heavens, how many hot strangers had moved into town when she wasn't looking? And why had they all said, why did they all suddenly need flowers? And obviously that's Ryan. I won't get into that.
Yes, yes. So you bring him in right away.
Right away. Yep.
But it isn't, you know, Holly isn't looking for somebody.
No, absolutely. And she didn't intend to have anyone in her life. She just figured the rest of her life she would just be devoted to Lydia until Lydia, you know, grew up, got turned 18 or whatever, and could sort of have a little measure of independence, however much she could. But then she meets Ryan, and it turns out he was absolutely the perfect man for her. And Ryan, who all his life thought all his adult life figured he wasn't going to have a family because he didn't want to be the kind of dad his father was, and didn't feel like, you know, he felt like he'd figured out his life. He was a military helicopter pilot, knew what he wanted to do. Living in a small town with a single mom was not ever on his radar. And then suddenly he meets Holly and falls for Lydia first. He falls for her little girl first. And then
Well, thank you. That was Rayanne Thane reading from Snowkissed. Tell me a little bit about, well, actually talking about Snowkissed, you know, Holly's a floral designer, has a floral shop. Did you know much about that line of work before you started writing this?
No, not at all. I had to do some research. I did a lot of looking online for pictures. I did a lot of research on, you know, what are Christmas arrangements? What are the flowers? I mean, I've received many flowers in my life. I'm fortunate enough that I have a husband who brings me flowers a lot. And you know, people in the publishing industry sometimes send me flowers. I've had some beautiful arrangements, but I don't know flowers much. So I had to do quite a bit of research about that.
Was that fun for you?
Oh, it's always fun. That's my favorite part of writing. I love the research part. I love the creating the characters, the planning of figuring out who they are and what their story is going to be. But I really love getting into, I could go down a rabbit hole of anything and find out all kinds of great things. And I don't know any other writer who's not the same way, who just doesn't love the research part of it, because it's just, we're all so curious about life. I think that's one of the things that makes us writers, is we're curious about why people do what they do. And maybe that comes from my journalism background, where, you know, that was my favorite part of being a journalist and being a reporter in any way, was talking to people and hearing their stories and kind of figuring out that everybody has a story, everybody, you know, and people love to talk about what they do and why they do it. And I really enjoyed that part of the journalism part of the process. But so now I guess that comes out in the research, where I dig into things and follow message boards. And, you know, sometimes I talk to people if I know they have a particular career, you know, I'll ask them, research what they do and say, how would this person handle this situation and this medical, I might have a medical situation and I have some medical resources, people that I know, and I'll reach out to them and say, okay, what would be the background that would end up with this person in this situation, and how would they get there and how would they fix it? You know, that sort of thing.
Now, how about Ryan with being in the military? Was that something you also had to research?
I did. Yeah, I did have to research. I do have some family members that are in the military, so they've helped me along the line. And whenever I've done any kind of military character, in this particular case, I don't know anybody in the Navy, so that was all new. So I had to do quite a lot of research on what kind of training would he need to be a helicopter pilot. Why do people become helicopter pilots who want to fly? Why do they do that instead of becoming like Navy fighter pilots on like a top gun kind of thing? And it was really interesting for me to write that. His dad had been a fighter pilot in the Air Force, so he didn't want the Air Force because he didn't want to be his dad. He didn't want to be a fighter pilot, but he loved anything flying. So he went into helicopters kind of to defy his dad, maybe, or to be different from his dad.
Yeah. And he says something about, about fighter pilots only have one thing that they do, whereas helicopter pilots are search and rescue and medical emergency.
They're the Swiss Army knife.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
They do everything. There's so many things that helicopter pilots can do in the military. And it was interesting to me to think about that, because I didn't really consider the fact that, you know, they're out doing search and rescue things, like you said. They're out, they can be civilian search and rescue too. They can go out when there's floods and help people, you know, not necessarily like the Coast Guard, but they're still out there in the middle of things helping people. And I really enjoyed that part of it.
I've been on a helicopter once, did a helicopter ride out from Las Vegas to the Grand Canyon. And it was cool. Yeah. It was very noisy.
That's a beautiful area. We spend a lot of time in southern Utah, which is just a little ways away from Las Vegas. It's a couple hours from Las Vegas.
Oh,
and I just love that area.
Yeah. So, Rayanne, you write more than 2 books a year on average.
And I'm down to 2. I will say early in my career, I was writing 3, but they were shorter books. They were like 60,000, 65,000 books, words. And so I could do 3 a year now, because every summer I write a women's fiction novel, which is, it's for summer. I write it, you know, not necessarily in the summertime, but it comes out in the summer. And they are more, I would say, complicated. They have multiple characters and subplots, and they take more time than necessarily a straight romance might have done early in my career, just because I really love writing about families and, you know, sister interactions and that sort of thing. And so I'm bringing in more elements, which definitely it has to be more layered, more complicated, you know, not necessarily a linear story like a romance can be. And I would say my Christmas stories are not necessarily, like you mentioned, they're not necessarily a strictly a romance, because there's certainly other family elements, but it's a little more linear than my summer books.
So where is the dividing line between a book that would be marketed as a romance and a book that would be marketed as women's fiction?
I wish I knew the answer to that. For me, I tell people, well, I write women's fiction with strong romantic elements, because my books are always romance. That's my heart. I'm a romantic. I'm an idealist, I guess. And I definitely believe in the happy ever after. But I also believe many people have to deal with other things in their life before they're in a place that the romance can make sense for them. And so those are the things that I sort of bring out a lot more in my summer books, I guess, speech books, you want to call them. But really, there is a very fine line between each one. And if it's just a well-told story, you know, people like the romance part of it. I don't write sexy books, and that can be an issue when in contemporary romance, you know, because how do you fill 80,000 words if you're not going to write the sex scenes that take up a significant portion of the book? And so I do have to bring in a lot of those other family elements to move the plot forward. Otherwise, you know, my people aren't spending, you know, pages and pages sleeping together. And so I have to figure out how else am I going to fill those pages? And I don't have demons, and I don't have, you know, paranormal elements and dragons and all those things that help move the plot forward. So really, it's just digging deep into the characters and people that are like people that we know, you know, that have problems similar to the people that are in our lives, you know, that they have to work through.
Do you have, like, do you know right now the next 3, 4, 5 books that you're writing, what they're going to be, or do you?
No. I'm working on the book right now that will be coming out next Christmas. I finished the book for next summer. After that, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do. I have some ideas, but I haven't really done more than think about them. I'll probably spend some time over the holidays, or, you know, maybe it'll wait till I finish the book that I'm working on. I do a plot group every year in February. I get together with some writer friends, and we bring an idea that we have, and they help us sort of develop the story and develop the characters into a full-fledged story. And we do that for each other. That's the joy of it. And there's a really great symbiotic relationship that we can have with each other that to help each other figure out the stories that we're writing. And so I'll probably have the rough idea for what I'm doing after the Christmas book, and I'll take it to that plot group, and they'll help me kind of figure it out and turn it into a fully fledged story.
Okay. That's interesting. So will you always have the entire kind of plot arc determined before you start writing?
I do what I think the story should be. The characters sometimes change that, but I'm very much a plotter, and I do a pretty extensive outline. I like to do a scene by scene outline where I know, okay, this is what's happening here and there. And it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes I get writing and I think this is not working. I need to change things. So I have to, and then I just kind of write off the cuff and figure it out as I'm going, and then go back and fix maybe the things that I'd already set up to make those work better. But I've found through all these many years of writing that for me, my particular process is that I need to know where I'm going, or I end up wandering around unnecessarily. So if I spend all that time on the front end, it saves me so much pain in the middle and on the back end of trying to figure out how did I get here and how am I going to fix this and make it all come together.
So do you start with the character or do you start with the situation?
Character, always character. I think my books are very much character driven. And so I always know who they are and what their arc's going to be, what their demons are, what their wounds are. And that's what I spend a lot of time figuring this out. And I usually have one character figured out, one character that I know I want to write about. And then I have to figure out who's the perfect person to either bring out the worst in them for what they're dealing with or help them resolve it. And how, and what are their demons and wounds and issues that they need to resolve that complement the other person's, or that the other person can help them get through.
Okay, so now when you're writing like this book where you sort of knew who all the side characters were because they had been in other books as well.
Not quite all of them, I will say. I knew Holly, but I had no idea the hero of this one. I knew Holly, and even the first book, I didn't know really Holly's story. I didn't know who that she had a daughter. I didn't even mention her daughter in that one. She was just a friend of them. And I don't even know if she appeared on screen. I think they mentioned her as a friend. And so, and they might've had dinner together. I'm trying to remember. That was, again, many books ago, 5 books ago that I wrote. I can't quite remember how I set that up. But in the second book in the series, I mentioned that she had a special needs daughter, but I still didn't know who her hero was. And it wasn't really until I sat down. I knew that her husband had left her in that book, that he recently left her, that they were struggling with things, but I didn't know where I was going to take that. If I was going to have a reunion story with the husband, or if I was going to, you know, set something else up. I didn't know until I sat down and figured out who is she, what does she do for a living? What is she struggling with? And then it all kind of came, and it's every book to me feels like a miracle because it start out with nothing. And I think, where am I going to go with this? I kind of have something. And then by the time you're done, you have a fully fledged book that just kind of came out of you somehow. I still don't know. It's magical to me every single time, you know, that I just don't, there's, I know it's hard work. I know intellectually what it is. I know it's that hard work in the years of experience and the, you know, there's nothing like just sitting down and doing it. There's nothing that is magic about that part of it, but still the creative process is still so beautiful to me. The fact that this thing that's in my head suddenly is this, you know, that I can hold in my hands.
And you really it sounds like you enjoy the process.
I do. There's something magical. I mean, it's hard. I'm not going to lie. It's hard. And there are days I think I don't want to do this or, you know, I'd rather be doing anything else, but sitting down and pouring my brain onto the page, you know, but I love having written. I love, at the end of the day, when the workday has been great, there's no feeling better than knowing that you did something in that scene that you needed to do, and you were able to bring those emotions out that you wanted to on the page. And it is really just an enjoyable process all the way around.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Rae Ann Thane, author of Snowkissed. So when you are writing, is it do you have a set schedule that you, you know, do you treat it like a job that you have to show up 9 to 5, or are you more flexible?
Well, I've had to be flexible because of our son with special needs somewhat, you know, but he goes to a day program. He's 28 now. He's aged out of the school system. Before, it would be as soon as he'd get on the bus, I would sit down and work, you know. Now it's as soon as the van comes to get him for his day program, or as soon as I take him there, I sit down and write. I'm lucky enough that I have an office outside of my house. So we have, you know, I can walk through the backyard to a building that's not my house. Ah. And so I'm away from the chaos of things here. And so that's my the walking through the backyard to this other building, you know, it feels like my commute to work. I know when I walk in there, that's the only purpose of that structure is my office. And so that's my workplace, and walking there helps me. It was hard for me when I was writing in my house because, you know, you have a million other things going on. Someone's watching TV in the other room. And I have great empathy for people who that's what they have. And I understand, and it can be done certainly beautifully. Most people do. But for me, in our situation, it worked best for me to have a separate place that I could go to leave all the stress and anxiety of caregiving and all the things at home. And so that's my process. I walk over to my office, sit down, get all my things ready. I like to have a TV on when I'm working because I don't have a show on. I have the voice muted or the sound muted, but I like to put on like live streams around the world so I can look up and see a different scene somewhere. So I'll do like Christmas markets when I'm when I'm working on a Christmas book, so I can look up and see a Christmas market, or I'll do, you know, a summer, somebody walking through the forest or something like that I don't need to pay attention to. It's just a different scene to see as I look up from my computer, you know.
Do you sometimes get inspiration from that? Or
sometimes, you know, just especially when it's like when I really need to feel like I'm in the mountains, I love to put on people hiking through the mountains. There are a lot of people who just record themselves with no sound walking through the mountains. You can hear the birds and things like that. And that does really help you get in the mood when you need to put yourself in a scene. Maybe you're not feeling it. Maybe it's a cloudy, ugly day where you live and you want to be on a sunny day and you want to feel that mood. It's easy to do that. YouTube has been an amazing thing for writers.
Now, do you write completely on computer or do you do some of the plotting or things on paper?
I've always done some on paper. I have an iPad that really helps me with my plotting, helping me organize the scenes. I have a certain app that I can use that I can move scenes around. I'll write them on like index cards and I can move that around. And that really does help me, especially when I'm writing the women's fiction books where I do multiple points of view. Typically in my romance books, I have a female point of view and male point of view. But when I'm writing the summer beachy books, I tend to have two heroines, a main heroine and a secondary heroine. Sometimes I've even had three, you know, where I've done three stories interwoven, and then I'll have like four or five points of view, and it helps me to put those on index cards of different colors for each point of view so I can see, okay, visually I've got way too many scenes that are pink in this person's point of view. I don't have enough purple in this person's point of view, so I can see the setup of the story structure and move scenes around if they're not working where I have them to flow better for the story.
And that's in an app. The index cards are an app, not actual physical index cards.
I was lucky enough that I found this app like many, many years ago. I think maybe even 10 years ago at this point. It was called Index Card, but it's not available anymore in the App Store. They don't support it anymore. I've been able to I've tried to find other ones and they don't quite work the same, but there are many index card apps out there that you can find. I have a friend who actually does it on actual index cards. That's how she plots her book, as she writes. Well, she'll write it on her computer, but then she'll write each scene on an actual different colored index card. And she lays them out on the floor to see, you know, what color needs to go where for what scene, you know, and then she'll put those all in order in a box. So she just pulls out the next scene, knows what she needs to write that day, because that's the next scene, the index card in the box, you know.
Now,
she was inspiration for that.
Do you write the book in order?
I do. I don't like to skip around very much because for me, it's part of the discovery process of the story. Even though I've plotted it, there's something different that comes about as you're actually writing the dialogue and the you know, descriptions and things like that. And so for me, I don't like to skip ahead and write something because that sort of messes me up for the story. I always tell people, you know, we all have our own process. This was what works for me. I write a really rough first draft in order so that I know where the story is going to be. That my first draft might include some dialogue. It might include, you know, some of the action scenes and some of the character description, but most of that comes in the second draft when I'm trying to figure out, you know, I'll leave lots of holes, say, and capital letters say, I need to write some sort of, you know, pacing here. The pacing needs to be better here. I would need to write some description of the mountains that she's looking at or something like that. And then when the second draft, I'll go through and fix all those things that I've left holes for.
And why do you think that works for you to, it's sort of like, well, those are harder to write and so I'm just going to skip over this to get to the end.
I think some of it is that. And for me, I think some of it is my subconscious needs a little more time to figure those things out. And I need to know, I need to have all the pieces on the board out before I can fill in the holes. I need to know where exactly I'm going with this story. Then I will know what those people need to, what their thought process is. Once I get to know them through writing the scene, I can write their internal dialogue much better because I know who they are now. Okay. Because I've written their story. So I call it the discovery draft, and it's kind of where I'm really discovering the story. Even though I've plotted it, like I said, it's never exactly what I plan. You know, I can even change, you know, the major things about the characters as I'm going because it's not working for me and it doesn't feel like it's working for the story. So I can change their occupation or whatever. And if I have to go rewrite that whole thing, the whole thing that I've done before, you know, that's much harder work than leaving it blank and then going back in and filling that in,
yeah,
if that makes sense. Yeah. That's just what works for me. Like I tell people, yeah, my process is my process. Your process is your process. Everybody has their own way of doing things, but that's what I figured out works for
me. So the discovery draft, and then you come back through and do a second draft where you're filling in the holes, writing dialogue, writing description, but I'm assuming you're not done at the end of that.
No. Then the third draft is the polished draft. I call it the polished draft. And that's where I go through and just fix it so that it flows better, so that the dialogue sounds more authentic. And that's where I sort of finesse every word that I can to make it sound the way I want it to. And then we have the edit process. So that at that point I turn it into my editor. Then she usually goes through it and has developmental edits that she gives me back to say, you know, this, I don't like this scene drags a little bit. Can you tighten that up and things like that? So then I go through and fix that. And then we have the copy edit draft. So basically at least three drafts on my end before I send it to anyone. And then, and sometimes there'll be four because sometimes even after I do the polished draft, something might not feel right. So I have to go back through and kind of figure out what doesn't feel right.
Okay. So I'm just, you must write really quickly when you're writing.
Actually consider myself a slow writer. I can do about 10 pages a day on a really good day. I can do 12 or 13 pages if I've had a lot of time to work, but that's about it. It's just mainly doing it 6 days a week, you know?
So which one of these steps takes the longest?
The second draft definitely takes the longest. That's the one. And I have to admit that I sometimes call that the slog draft because it's just getting through it and making it, because I have to figure it out at that point. I can't like kick it down the street a little ways, you know, because at that point I'm like, I got to figure this out. Even though it takes time, it takes a lot of thinking, it takes a lot of, you know, finessing. I have to get it right now because I'm at the point where I have to make the story work together.
Well, which step do you enjoy the most?
I think the polished draft, the just finessing the prose and getting it the way I want it. But I will say I really enjoyed the plotting part before I even sit down to write. I like that part, thinking about who these people are and what they might be dealing with and what I can bring to the page that's new and fresh for my readers this time. I like that part of it.
Now, when you're finished and it goes off to the editor, do you take a break? Waiting for it to come back, or do you start on the next
one
right away?
I'm writing two books a year, so I have to start the next one. I usually know by the time I finish a book, I know what the next book is going to be and what I need to do for it. So I give myself a few days, you know, I will say, even though I'm working on the next book, it's not with the same manic energy that I finished the previous book. So I might like have a really crazy month or two of getting a book finished. And then it takes me a long time to ramp up to that really crazy month or two that I know I need to do to finish a book. So, you know, like right now I'm working on the Christmas book, but I'm not quite done with the first draft yet. So I know that January and February are just going to be insanely crazy for me as I try to get that book done and get the next two drafts done.
And of course, then you spend some time doing publicity, marketing,
right,
the book, shows like this. Right. Do you also go to writers' conferences? Do you teach at all?
You know, I did early in my career. I did a lot of things like that. A lot of conferences. I gave a lot of workshops, and I still do quite a few like virtual workshops. I don't go to a lot of conferences. I usually pick one or two a year. Just again, my personal situation is a little harder. Our son is nonverbal, nonmobile, requires total care. So it's hard for me to leave him with someone else. And so it's a little bit difficult for me to juggle in leaving him for 3 or 4 days for a writer's conference. So I do a lot of virtual stuff because that's easier for me to handle in our situation.
That makes sense.
I love it. I mean, I always do the, like I mentioned before, we always go for three nights anyway to a beach house in California for our writer's retreat with my dear friends. And that is sort of, I tell my husband, I'm doing this whether you can deal with it or not. You're going to have to. I'm sorry. Even if you're sick, you're going to have to deal with it because I need this for my mental health, you know.
So that's the plot group?
We do. And so it's really, and I say plot group, we do work really, really hard for 2 full days there. You know, everybody gets half a day. There's 4 of us and everybody gets half a day where we're just talking about that person's book strictly. And it is hard work. We record it all. And then you can take the transcript back and figure out your story from that point. But there's a lot of just talking and hanging out and, you know, catching up and that sort of thing, which we all need as writers.
How did you find this group?
You know, through writer conferences and things like that. The one main person that I plot with, we started out writing at this about the same time. We were pretty close to, and we wrote for the same publisher. So there were a lot of things that we did back together in the day as we were writing for that publisher. And then our careers kind of took a different
direction.
Arc, you know, well, we both write romance. She writes a little sexier romance than I do. And she writes much faster than I do. And so, you know, she's written many more books than I have at this point. But, you know, and about 10 years ago, we were about at the same place in our careers. We had both, you know, had pretty good things going on for us. And we both, you know, New York Times bestsellers and things like that. And so we kind of connected again because we had started out in the same place and now we were kind of at the same place and we've become dear friends. And so she's the one that we kind of started with. We kind of thought, who else can we get? We had other friends that were writers that we liked the way they plotted and they thought, and we liked their writing. And so we asked if they would be interested, and then you just sort of experiment and see what works. And
Now
we have a pretty good thing going.
Well, it sounds like a great group. I'm envious.
You have to trust each other. You know, there's an element of trust, and you have to, I think we all bring different things to the table, which is really important because, you know, there are people who write really sweet stories like I do, and I tend to focus on the emotion. There are other people who write witty dialogue. And so they help me because that's not necessarily my strength. You know, they can help me say, well, you could do this or that as you're writing these characters and set this up. And it really is a great relationship.
Well, Rayanne, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I enjoyed Snowkissed. It was such a pleasure. And I want to close with a quote from, I don't know who this person is, Burton Hillis, but said, "The best of all gifts around any Christmas tree, the presence of a happy family all wrapped up in each other."
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun to talk.
Thank you. And I look forward to many more books.
Thank you.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.